The next matter on calendar for argument is Alexa Estrella Raposo and Zachary Thornton versus United States of America, case number 25-4752. And each. It looks like we'll have more room, so I'll wait and let everyone get settled. Okay, so we are on case 25-4752. Each side has 15 minutes. And I think we just have one person arguing on each side. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right, we're ready. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice representing the United States. And I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Okay.
The government brings three issues in this appeal, just to list them briefly for you. First, the district court erred by applying a mere negligence standard in finding recklessness on the part of the government doctor here. Second, the court awarded excessive damages for non-economic damages that far exceeded the comparables that we provided. Third, the court violated the plain language of an Alaska statute by using short-term interest rates to determine the present value of future economic damages. The Alaska statute requires long-term rates.
Let's take your first issue, the application of negligence standard. The doctor was asked, the plaintiff's doctor was asked, without objection by you, by the state, by the government, whether this action was reckless, and he answered, it was reckless in four respects. Why is that not sufficient to sustain the verdict?
So our argument is that the district court
Judgment.
Sorry. So maybe two answers. First of all, we are saying again, when you look at what the district court said, the district court applied a mere negligence standard. And then I think to answer your question, I understand plaintiffs to be saying, even if that's the case, this court should affirm because the record can only be read I'm sorry, go ahead.
The doctors testified that this was a reckless action. The application of lateral force of 40 pounds was reckless. It should not be more than 4 pounds. He was allowed to give the legal opinion that this was a reckless act without objection by the government. Why isn't that evidence that puts to bed the issue?
Well, first of all, he also testified that Dr. Penberthy may not have known he was using
excess levels. That goes to the weight of the evidence.
And he also assumed that Dr. Penberthy used excess lateral traction. He didn't explain why he came to that conclusion. But again, I think I'm trying to make a different argument than the one that you're going to. And our argument is precedent to that, is that the court should remand because the district court didn't even get to that. The district court said, and just quoting from page 28 to 29 of the opinion, paragraph 36 of the opinion said that so you're asking about the excess lateral traction. That's on page 30. The court said this was reckless because Dr. Penberthy knew or had reason to know that the excessive lateral traction would cause an unreasonable risk of harm. Well, the restatement, which Alaska has adopted, requires more than that. It requires knowledge of a risk substantially greater than that which is necessary to make his conduct negligent. So that's the error. The district court made the error by reciting and applying the wrong.
The district court cited the right law. Okay. So interestingly, to me, this does look like a Med-Mal case, and it looks like a negligence case. However, the district court did cite the right law, and what Judge Bea is saying, there was an expert that testified that this was reckless under the standard of the law. So then that puts us into a more of a clear error situation as opposed to sufficiency of the evidence. You know, and I worry looking at this that everything that happened here, if you just look at what all the facts are, but you absent all of the declarations that came in and the evidence that was a bench trial, that's a trier of fact, and the right law was cited as far as that goes. Now, are these facts, since it's not really, you're not really challenging the sufficiency of the evidence, are these facts now going to stand? Is everything going to be a reckless? Is every Med-Mal case going to become a reckless case?
So that's one of our concerns, right?
It is, but you don't really posture it very well. Like what Judge Bea is saying is you let an expert testify it was reckless. And then we have a standard of review that we look at things. And I guess what I'm telling you, if it were postured differently, I may not have this, you know, I think it looks like a Med-Mal case, but what the district court had and what we have to review and the standard of review that we have, I don't see how we get where you're asking us to go.
So, Your Honor, the government did not concede that the finding that there was an excessive lateral traction was reckless. We put on Evan, our own experts, and our own experts said that it wasn't. So we did contest.
The trial came down. We contested the issue. The district court, as the trier of fact, weighing both of those experts and chose to favor the experts of the plaintiffs or the reposos in this particular case. So if there was evidence there and that's what the district court believed, it's not the same. I'm having a hard time getting over the standard of review here.
But I think the key phrase there in your question was that was what the district court believed. We don't have that. The district court did when it was reciting the legal standards in the boilerplate at the very early part of the opinion. It quoted the restatement. We don't dispute that. But then when it actually applied the test, then you can look at paragraph 36.
Yeah, but it's just whether if it was a jury or it's a bench trial. When the right law is there, we assume that the trier of fact followed the right law. Well, now, the trier of fact didn't agree with you, but it's the right law was cited there.
But not when the court actually applied the law, right? The presumptions are always rebuttable. So I agree with you. When the court at the early part said, the restatement says this, okay, well, that's a presumption that the court was going to do the right thing. But then here, when the court actually got down to the business of finding whether this was reckless or not, the court applied the wrong law. It ignored what it said before and applied a mere negligence standard. That, in our view, is legal error.
What's your evidence of that?
I'm sorry?
What in paragraph 36 says that?
Oh, sorry. So paragraph 36, beginning on page 22, it says, right, the last sentence, the court concludes that Dr. Penberthy knew or had reasons to know that a vaginal delivery could create an unreasonable risk of physical harm to AENT. There's the words, unreasonable risk of physical harm. It doesn't state the restatement standard, which is you need something substantially greater than a regular risk. So the court, again, all we know is, all we have is what the court said. And when you get to what the court said, it's the wrong standard.
It was reckless.
And again, reckless applying the standard for mere negligence.
Get to your other points.
Yeah.
Yes. So our second argument is that the award for non-economic damages was excessive. We provided the court with three comparator cases, all involved brachial plexus injuries. The low of the awards was for $625,000 today. The high was for $2,195,000. Interestingly, the injuries in those cases were all more extensive than the injuries that the child suffered here, but those are the closest cases we found.
Can you add, I'm confused as to what the standard review is on this question, because it seems like there's some case law that says that it's a question of law whether or not something exceeds the upper limit. But then there's also case law that says that we reviewed these damages awards for clear error.
So we've said that it's clear error review. That's our position. But I take your point, and that when a court looks at comparator cases and assumes that a set of facts in this case and compares the two, it sounds very legal.
Yeah.
So one could say that is the proper way of looking at it. We've said, based on the Shaw case, that it's clear error. It's the Ninth Circuit case. I'm not sure it makes a big difference here, because, again, either way, the court's looking at the other cases and making a judgment. And the clear error standard review is, if there's a definite and firm conviction that there's a mistake.
Well, it might make a difference on the question of whether or not you waive the argument. If it's, you know, there was argument by your friends that you waived this argument and it wasn't presented. And if it's a legal question, then, you know, we're much more likely to address it, despite waiver. But if it's a factual question or abuse of discretion question, then we should not touch a waived argument, in my view.
So the government did raise the excessiveness of the request at the closing, and we mentioned that the plaintiffs were asking for 36 times what the Alaska cap is for medical malpractice cases. So we did waive it, and I think that's enough to preserve that issue. So again, we've given you some comparators. The plaintiffs have given you three comparators, Scott, Shaw, and Trevino, where the injuries involved were far more extensive and severe than in this case. Two of the cases, the child was a quadriplegic. The third case, they had extensive brain damage. It's nothing like that is going on in this case. So they say there's a sweet spot between those cases, but none of those cases are just remotely relevant to this case. And there are other cases that are similar. They have a bunch of out-of-circuit district court cases when the injuries were much more severe. And same for the parents. The parents' award was here for $500,000 each. We've given you the Trevino case from this court, where this court actually reduced an initial consortium award of $200,000 to $50,000 each.
What you're asking for is for us to reduce the non-economic damages or to remand it to the district court to reconsider in light of your comparator cases?
Remand and reconsider.
Right.
Unless the court has more questions on that, I think that covers that.
Sorry, do you happen to have EER site on where you raised it below, or non-economic damages? It was in closing, you're saying?
So it was in closing.
It looks to me like you argued that the damages amount should be capped at $250,000 due to lack of recklessness.
Right.
But I'm not sure at what point did you challenge the non-economic damages or argue that a non-economic award higher than $1 million would be excessive.
So I did find it. It's page 880 of the excerpts of record. And again, that's the point at which we said plaintiff's demand was excessive because it was 36 times what the $250,000 cap is.
Okay.
Our third issue.
That's not an argument as to comparator cases. That's an argument applying a $250,000 cap for negligence cases, but not to reckless cases. Mike, the question I think was that where did you argue that the damages were excessive and were such that a firm conviction that shocks the conscience of the court?
We did not make a comparator cases argument below. We think that what we did do is broad enough to preserve it, but I take your point. We didn't argue neither side.
Your short-term interest issues.
I'm sorry?
Your short-term interest, the short-term bond issues.
Oh, yes. So the Alaska statute says, requires using a present amount that if invested at long-term future interest rates in the best and safest investments. So here the plaintiff's expert used a mix of short-term and long-term rates. And we think that's error, and the court accepted that.
Pardon me, I hate to interrupt you, but I forgot to ask you a question. Are you raising an issue as to the amount of non-economic damages awarded the parents?
Yes.
You want to say something about that?
So yes, our argument is that was excessive because in the Trevino case, the court reduced the award from $200,000 to $50,000. That was a severely disabled child with cerebral palsy, limitations on all four limbs, And the award to the parents was reduced to $50,000. So we
think
that's...
you want that remanded to the district court to reconsider.
Yes, please. So in the discount rate, again, the Alaska statute requires using the long-term interest rates. And the district court here used a mix of short and long-term interest rates.
Is long-term and short-term defined in the Alaska statute?
It isn't, but it was conceded in this case that 3 months is short. And we conceded that 10 years is an acceptable long-term rate. But again, what we have here is a violation of the statute because the plaintiff's expert used a mix of 3 years, 3 months and 10 years. And the plaintiffs don't really have a response to this. They say, oh, the expert had a right to do that, but they don't explain why he did.
Well, the statute says best and, what is it, longest?
So if I could, the statute
best
says...
Best and safest investments. Couldn't there be an argument that a mix between long-term and short-term is the best and safest investment?
So that's what the plaintiff's expert said. I would point the court to Colleen versus the United States. That's one of your decisions. And the court interpreted what that means, and it said best and safest means low risk. So you're using bonds and not stocks, because stocks are very speculative. So what the plaintiff does is he tries to... it misinterprets how best and safest is used in the statute. And if, under his reading, it just reads there's a requirement of using short-term interest rates out of the statute.
Okay.
I am over my time. Well, I don't know, but I'd like to save anything I have left for rebuttal unless you have any questions.
I have nothing, but let me, I'll consider giving you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joel DeGangi for the appellee Reposos. I'd like to begin by visiting this subject of the failure to preserve. What the government did in this case is they kind of just stormed off in a huff. They didn't give the district court any chance to address the arguments that it's raising now. And if we proceed forward in that fashion, it really is opening, I think, a can of worms for this court in the future, because the government can come back and again and again and treat this court like a trial court. And we just don't think that's good policy. We don't think that's fair. In this case, I think it's important to draw a distinction, not only as to the recklessness, but also to the excessive issue.
I would like to talk to you about the recklessness, because that, and obviously, let me say, you know, obviously from the start, that obviously it's tragic when a child isn't, you know, that would be healthy, it isn't born, you know, that things happen and they're not healthy. And, you know, relative to deciding whether, okay, well, you should be thankful you're not a quadriplegic as opposed to you can't use your right arm. I mean, those are all, it's, you know, this child obviously has injuries that will continue on. So I don't want to be insensitive to that. This isn't a situation like some recklessness, you know, where you have doctors that are, you know, they're drunk when they're doing things, or they go off somewhere and leave the person birthing by themselves or something along those lines. This was a situation where obviously the doctor recognized what the shoulder problem was and the trapping, and it comes down to, so it wasn't a misdiagnosis of what was happening here. We got the 40-pound situation and how you get it out, and there's mentions of 42 seconds as opposed to 5 to 7 minutes about, I mean, it was a tense situation. I don't see anything, you know, I'm wondering if this is recklessness, how isn't every Med-Mal case where a person's below the standard of care reckless in these situations? I didn't see any of that going on.
Right. I understand your point. There's a number of issues here. First of all, there's precedent. There's Ninth Circuit precedent, such as United States versus Roast, where a Forest Service agent neglected to fix a gate. and that was deemed to be willful misconduct. There are the aviation cases, Hussein versus Olympic Airways, where an airline agent seated someone in near to a smoking section, and they had a sensitivity to smoke, and they were badly injured thereby, and that was deemed to be willful misconduct. There are other precedents. There is
willful, but recklessness in terms of what I'm seeing here is it proceeds, and then we have the trapped shoulder. The doctor goes in there, untraps it, and then the child has an injury.
Right,
and,
but we and, have we have we don't we have. Several
I mean, it's not
aspects.
Like the doctor jumped on the mother's stomach. It's not like the doctor was drunk. It's not like any
right.
of those things.
Well, the
but
doctor
I
doesn't.
Said,
the doctor doesn't have to be drunk or anything like
well, they
that.
Don't. They don't have to be. But the experts essentially, they testify as to what their opinion of. I'm not really sure that there are. They are supposed to testify as to the ultimate whether it's reckless or not. They can give their opinion,
right.
but it's up to the trier of fact, which in this case was a judge because it was a bench trial.
True.
If this were in front of a jury, it would be up to a jury.
True.
And I would have been, if I were a lawyer there, I would have been jumping and saying, like, why the person thought it was reckless or what about it was reckless, but I wouldn't let them conclude it was reckless in front of a jury. But whatever happens, so then I'm stuck with the standard of review.
What I want to say is there's a lot at stake here, and the doctor knows there's a lot at stake, and he actually knows that there's going to probably or possibly be a shoulder dystocia situation. He even discussed that with his assistant. This is a well-known and very severe problem. It's got acronyms for it. BBPI, OBPI. It's got, this is taught in medical schools.
Well,
this is a syndrome.
It's not diagnosed here. It's just, you know, the finder found that too much pressure was, and apparently you're supposed to do a certain way as opposed to lateral, and I'm
and if you get it, making. And if you get it wrong, you're going to get paralyzed.
Well, yeah. Or they said, and the child, but they also said that sometimes after whatever the initial problems are, work out. But here it didn't. And so I'm not, you know, but
any,
how is not every case where a doctor makes a mistake not a reckless case,
well,
in your view?
But when there's a lot at stake, you got to be careful. I would cite to this court its own decision in the Agujak case, where there was a failure to treat endocarditis, and the doctors took the very same position. They said that we've, in good faith and good attempts to meet the modified Duke criteria at issue in that case, we did our very best, and they made a very similar argument that the court is presenting here. And this court upheld the finding of recklessness in that case, a medical malpractice Federal Tort Claims Act case. The precedents really suggest, and I think I, rather than harp on the precedents, I think I want to go back to the clear error issue.
Well, that's what I said. The standard of review, I'm not looking at this. I don't think there's a sufficiency of the evidence argument here. I think I'm stuck with the standard of review. So maybe go to the damages.
Well, to the damages?
Well,
I'll
that I can avoid the standard review here.
I'll go to the. Are you saying?
Question before you move on.
Sure. Go ahead.
The reason why I think this shows it's, you know, the clear the recklessness standard is met is, as I understand it, the pressure you're supposed to pull is only five miles per hour. Is it
5 pounds per
pounds? Second. I'm sorry. Five pounds. But
and probably 5 miles per hour,
yeah,
as well.
It's slow. I mean, yeah. And then, but my understanding is that he applied 40 pounds. So that's eight times the standard of care. That to me is, yeah, clearly gets us into the recklessness threshold. Is
Thank
that
you.
One way to look
that,
at it?
That you hit part of my points here. Plus, there's this whole issue about the allowing and encouraging and acquiescing in the pushing and the fund.
That's not here right now, is it?
What's that?
That part isn't here. We're not considering the pushing part of it here, are
we? That's one of the lapses in care that we are maintaining. That's a pillar of the recklessness. And this brings up another question that seems to get lost here. We take these instances of recklessness in isolation. I don't do that. I go to Lockerbie case that we cited, and where it says expressly, we take the totality of circumstances in assessing whether or not there's true recklessness. Judge, did I understand you to say you wanted to go to the excessiveness issue? This wasn't preserved either. And but more importantly, I'd like to remind the court of...
Why wasn't it reserved? They denied liability. That's saying you shouldn't get any damages. So,
well, I mean, but there was no preservation once the judge issued their, once they made their award, there was never any attempt.
Didn't you argue this was 36 times $250,000?
Whatever.
They didn't argue the excessiveness of the damages before the district court, right?
Well, they didn't come back is our point. That's my point.
And is your point that they waived this issue?
Yes.
Was there a storming out of the courtroom? You said they went in a huff.
Well, they're storming out in the sense that they're not filing anything further. They just gave up on Judge Pett.
You know, I've had actually people storm out of the courtroom, you know.
I myself have stormed out.
You know, something along those lines that you're not saying that.
No, I'm saying stormed out in the sense that they had 28, they got a ruling. It was an adverse ruling. Under Rule 52B, they had 28 days. That's another interesting.
Could have done more is what you're saying, but they didn't kick this.
I don't want to be taken too literally on that. Right. That was my way of coming up with a picturesque way of saying they decided to give up on a court that issued an adverse ruling. They didn't give that district court any chance to address the points that they're making.
Your point is, if they didn't make a motion under 52, they waived it. You want us to hold that?
I think that if you disagree with the dollar amount award, you owe it to the district court to go back and give that court an opportunity to address the things that you're now arguing in front of this court.
Is there any case that says that?
There is Rule 52B says you have to do it within 28 days.
Yeah.
And we have precedent.
I don't think there's precedent that says if you don't do that, then you waived it.
But think about it. What's the point of the 28 days? Is that just a superfluity? I mean, that gets swallowed up here. I think the court has to consider the 28-day limitations period and at least ask. I think you have to reconcile this Fotopoulos case where the Ninth Circuit said in 1950, they said, we're just not going to hear an excessive argument case unless there's been something presented to the district court. And then you have the government's argument where they point to this Penetrante case and they take the position that you don't have to file anything with the district court. And I just think that that we have to reconcile that. We have to figure this out. And I figure it out this way. I say, hey, has there been an attack on the sufficiency of the evidence? And we don't think that questioning whether Judge Petchman understood the difference between recklessness and simple negligence or, we don't think that the damage, we think that the damages were excessive. We just don't, I think those arguments are not true attacks on the sufficiency of the evidence per se. And that, by the way, answers the question that you asked, Your Honor, about Rule 52. Rule 52, I believe it's A6. Am I correct about that? Rule 52, A6 says, Rule 52, A5 says a party may later question the sufficiency of the evidence. That's a key phrase, and that may be therein may lie the key to what this whole thing about the 28 days and everything else. So we would have to ask, has there been an attack on the sufficiency of the evidence. And in this case, there is not. We don't see a parading of evidence. We don't see any discussion about the experts. We don't get very far in. All we get from the government is an innuendo that the judge may not have understood.
But I'm sorry, I don't understand. Your 52A5 says a party may later question the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the findings, whether or not the party requested findings, objected to them, move to amend them, or move for partial findings.
Right. And
it
I
says
still,
you don't have to object to them.
That it does say that, but it also says sufficiency on the basis of sufficiency of the evidence. And then you go to A6 and it talks about clear error. And it says that we must give due regard to the trial court's opportunity to judge the witness's credibility, which, by the way, if an expert takes the stand and renders an opinion that something is reckless and they have the right to testify on ultimate issues, but even on the basis of their reasoning and give enough evidence upon which Judge Petschmidt can make a recklessness finding, that's enough. And then you go down to B, and it says on a party's motion filed no later than 28 days after the entry of judgment. Why have a 28-day period if the government can just march off after an adverse ruling anytime it wants without any 28-day ruling or anything else on any grounds? We think the judge didn't understand.
Is there an argument that the judge violated the law in awarding that excessive fines? I'm sorry, excessive penalty? Because there is some case law that says it's a question of law whether or not you exceed the upper limits.
Well,
and that's, you know, that's de novo review versus clear error.
Right. This is not.
Okay, let's say their award had been $5 billion.
Five, how many?
Billion.
Okay.
Then $5
billion. All right.
No, you say they waived a legal challenge to that amount?
I would say that is way in excess of the Scott case. That's what I would say in response to
but
that.
But as a matter of law, right?
As a matter of law. So, you know, you go to Scott and you take, you know, you do your inflation calculation and you come up with. And by the way, Scott is not Trevino in the sense that Scott applies Alaska law. I want to get that on the record. The Trevino and Shaw are Washington cases where they're applying Washington law. Why does the government think that's so important? I submit that Scott is far more important. It applies Alaska law, and it's an award for $5.2 million. And granted, the injury in that case was severe, but it's $1.2 million more. Is this court going to
stop you? You're over your time.
Yep.
I want to find out what questions the court still has of you before I have you sit down.
Okay.
You have any additional questions?
I don't have any further questions.
All right. So we don't have any additional questions. Why don't you take a minute to close?
We didn't even get to the discounting.
Well, that's, I can't.
I know.
No wine with the cheese here. Okay, just I'm giving you extra time.
Right, so I understand. This is my way of summarizing.
Okay.
We didn't get to the discounting. It would be an abuse of discretion standard. Mr. Richards used a mix, and Colleen versus United States uses the word mix. So we think that that's okay. This thing about the recklessness, don't consider just each instance in isolation, consider the totality of circumstances. On the excessiveness of the verdict, we provide an extensive survey that seems to have gotten lost in the discussion here. And look at the amounts, $10 million in some instances, many more millions of dollars. And then look at the precise injury, Erb's palsy for an infant, Erb's palsy for an infant, Erb's palsy for an infant. And you can say, well, some of those were from out of state. True, and some of them are from Louisiana, one of them's from Michigan, one of them's from Iowa, and their Trevino and Shaw are from Washington. We really don't, the only real case we have is Scott, and Scott's the red line. And above that, then I'd say, yes, you have a point as far as the excessiveness. But below that, we get into retrying the case on appeal, which we don't think the Ninth Circuit should get into. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your argument. All right, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The last issue first on the discount rate, the plaintiffs rely on the Colleen case. In that case, the court was interpreting Washington law. Washington does not have a statute like the Arizona, like the Alaska statute at issue here. It allows district courts discretion to use mixes of long and short-term bonds. So that case is not helpful to them in the way they think it is. Scott is definitely not helpful. It is the only Alaska case, but it's not a brachial plexus injury case to begin with. Second, the injuries were just remarkably more extensive than what's going on here. Quadriplegia, the child couldn't speak, feed itself, or walk. That's a relevant comparator. I'm sorry, but that doesn't work. And the plaintiffs in their brief, they rely on the Washington cases too, like Shaw and Tavino. And we're just trying to give you the best comparators we can from sister states, like Washington is the closest one, right, I think. So I think that's helpful and relevant. The Penetrante case that he mentioned does say that this court considered an excessive damages argument on appeal, that it was legal error, even though it was not made in a Rule 52 motion below. So that case allows the court to consider that issue. And finally, Judge Bloomfield, you mentioned the recklessness with respect to the excessive lateral traction. And our point on that is two things. First of all, again, the district court didn't even get to that. He just assumed that this set would satisfy recklessness by applying a mere negligence standard. That's our big point. We want a remand. We want to hear. We want an application of the proper standard, which the court itself recited but then didn't apply. And then on the evidence, Dr. Gubernick, he assumed that there was excessive lateral traction. He didn't actually find that there was. He just said, well, there must be. And he also said that Dr. Penbury may not even known he was doing it. So how is that reckless? I just don't get that.
Over your time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted. No. I'm not taking it.